I have a confession confession to make. I used to read the Bible in church. Now, I know you're supposed to do a little of that. Here's what we're talking about this week. Let's listen to 6 or 8 verses. But as children are wont to do, my 10 or 11-year-old self would cast about for something to do during services that, you know, occasionally were pitched at different audiences than myself. And this being church, there were always Bibles close to hand. And I would invariably, on a Sunday morning, eventually get to the point where I was finding myself picking up the text, the Bible, and either following up on some little thread that was sticking out of the sermon or the scripture for that day, or just sort of finding my place in that soap opera of sex and violence that is the Old Testament, and just sort of finding my way through it. And, you know, there's some crazy stuff in there, right? In fact, there's more than a little crazy stuff in there, stuff that doesn't make any sense at all. And I had 30 or 40 minutes a week just to think about it. And so my sense of the Bible from my earliest memories is that it is, in fact, a text that makes you stop and say, huh. It's sometimes because of attitudes or practices that the text seems to be endorsing. Really? That was the way to react in that situation? I'm surprised. I'm skeptical. Or equally confounding, texts that looked at a character having a straightforward or honest reaction and saying, no, 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 no. That's a bad mistake. And I think to myself, really? Because that's what I would have done in that situation. Exactly what I would have done. Or because something just seems to be missing. We have too little information to understand what's really going on there. Who is really involved? What are these people thinking? Where are they coming from? What has happened to them up until this point where they suddenly show up in these biblical narratives? Because of that, through these miracles, little miracles of compression, you know, these stories take a whole human life and they put it into 2 lines sometimes. Or because of ellipsis, you know, they leave out the crucial details. Sometimes it seems like biblical text can mean anything. And it's hard to even know where to start. Today's text is one of those stories that really could mean anything. For, I guess, decades now, it's left me stumped. And I guess that the invitation to practice Midrash this morning on the Thomas story, to treat these impasses in the text as invitations to enter the story and really spend some time trying to figure out what's going on there, it's been kind of like, I don't know, a bat signal, kind of, you know, a shining up in the skies over Gotham City saying, you know, come on, there's work to be done here, sort of dig in. And it's really encouraged me to sit down and look at the text and really try to wrestle with what makes me uncomfortable about it. In fact, a puzzled reader, an uncomfortable reader, I think that's a reader who is ready to bring the biblical text out into the world and to bring the world into the text. Well, I've forgotten the specific Sunday morning on which I was reading this post-resurrection account in the Gospel of John for the first time. It may have been Easter Sunday itself. And I decided to do a little reading ahead, though, to see how the story ended. But I remember the feeling of saying, wait a minute, this story of Doubting Thomas. I'm attracted to Thomas, but it feels like the text is censuring him, is somehow disapproving of him. And maybe it reminded me of the times I myself felt called out or challenged by others, especially in my reactions to the Christian story. I don't know if any of you have shared this experience, but for me, adolescence was a time in which I often felt like teachers and peers spent a lot of energy besieging that little bunker of my selfhood, trying to sort of poke me and prod me and question my faith, my very capacity for belief. You know, are you doing it right? You better be doing it right, because if you're not doing it right, you know, everything is at stake. That was a very uncomfortable feeling. And I gathered or sensed that among this community of faith around me, there was one major authorized, acceptable reaction to the Thomas story. Now, this is probably selling them short, but this is how I felt at the time. So the reaction that is okay was, wow, I believe, and I never got to see the risen Christ. I never got to inspect his wounds. What a faithless loser Thomas was. Glad I'm not like him, right? And that bothered me because it seems to make Thomas a target. He's taking the fall. He's a punchline. He's a counterpoint to someone or something in the story that's actually admirable or true. And I almost felt like the text was bullying him, right? And I didn't like that. In fact, my reaction, I remember thinking, was there's only one way to go here. And that is to acknowledge that this whole story seems like a setup, a frame-up, an inoculation against doubt that warns everybody that you're expected to believe things they can't possibly know through faith. And if you have any doubts, well, not good for you, right? You fail, right? And that was really how I felt, you know, I had to respond to the story of Thomas. But that's not satisfying either. Simply rejecting John's story doesn't do anything, doesn't allow me to carry it with me and let it work on my understanding. If this story is about doubt, as directly as any story in the Bible is, and if doubt is something that I feel is actually a deep-rooted part of my personality and my response to the world, well then, I need a more nourishing and useful way of reading this particular story. And one key for me is to think about Thomas's seemingly impious, hyperbolic reaction. You know, it's shocking, right? It's scandalous. When told by his friends that Jesus is alive, that Jesus has risen, Thomas says, "What? Come on, forget it. I'll never believe until I actually stick my hands in the wounds in his side," right? This is a shocking thing to propose, right? It reminds me of just something that happened to me a few weeks ago. I attended a memorial service for one of my dear friends from college. And this friend was both brilliant and brash. He was earthy. He would say just about anything, especially if it was unexpected or shocking. He was very funny, but also very kind of scurrilous in his humor. And the thing was, he was often right. The shocking things he would say were often true things, and they made you think. Sometimes it was uncomfortable. So this was an amazing service, and for me, the highlight was probably his father's eulogy for his son. His father got up in front of the church, and he actually brought the urn with my friend's ashes with him, and he placed it up front. And he even joked that probably it wasn't a good idea to set the urn on the lectern here because, you know, one elbow and whoosh, off it would go, right? And you could feel a ripple of, you know, recoil from the congregation, right? But it was like Chekhov's gun, right? Once you mention that happening, it's all you can think about, right? It's going to happen. So he goes through a long, shambolic, meandering set of stories about his son's life and about his relationship to his son, which show both good parts and difficult parts of their relationship. And finally, at the end, he takes the urn and he picks it up and he has it right here. And he says goodbye to his son. And he kisses the urn. And then he looks at the congregation. We're all like crying. There's not a dry eye in the house. And he looks at the congregation and he says, "I hope I got the right cheek." Well, I think that's a pretty brave way to say a last goodbye to a child's mortal remains, right? It reminded me of the story of Isaac, which means he laughs, right? Or he will laugh. The story of Abraham and Sarah as well as parents, and the laughter in that story that is both bitter and not, and is true, right? So that story reminds me, actually, like the Thomas story, that Easter is not just a story that is unambiguously happy, right? It's a story that has a bitter thread that runs through it. As mortal people, we all face death. We must face death at some time in our lives, all of us. And perhaps, like Thomas, if we are honest about our reactions, as stark and as shocking as they may be, perhaps there's a truth there as well. So I'm defending Thomas this morning, if you haven't gathered yet. I'll give you just a couple of philosophical quotes that seem germane here. The first is from David Hume, who says, "To be a philosophical skeptic is the first and most essential step towards being a sound, believing Christian." That's a good one. Although it probably may have turned my teenage self to the other team and said, okay, well, then I'm not going to be skeptical, right? Because maybe it's more sort of rebellious to go the other way. But I take his point here. René Descartes, if you would be a real seeker after truth, it's necessary at least once in your life that you doubt all things. And finally, Voltaire. Doubt is an uncomfortable condition, but certainty is a ridiculous one. All right, so in our story, Thomas is uncomfortable. The disciples speak with him, and he finds that he can't get with them. He is made uncomfortable by their story. Is that admirable, or is that ridiculous? Well, John clearly chose Thomas to embody doubt. The evidence is really clear in the text. The first four verses set up a joyful reunion between the risen Christ and the disciples. And in a few lines, they go from terrified to distraught, to overjoyed, to filled with energy and purpose. But verse 24 comes in immediately then and sets up the real tension in the story. Until now, it's been all good news. But verse 24 reminds us that Thomas is about to come along and not get it, right? Thomas, who was called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. And I almost feel sorry for the rest of the disciples here. Their moment of absolute reversal, of overwhelming joy, is mentioned, but almost immediately put off to the side. It's just a setup for the main event, which is really Thomas's reaction to the story. Thomas is the one who gets a deep interiority. Thomas is the one who has an all too human reaction to the situation. Why was Thomas called the twin? Well, that's a translation from the Greek didymos, which in turn comes from the Aramaic name derived from the word for twin. In John's gospel, this kind of citation of an Aramaic term with its Greek translation tends to underscore larger thematic or theological points. For example, we encountered one of those last week when Mary Magdalene calls Jesus Rabboni, teacher. We should note here that twins in many cultures have negative associations, and I apologize for those of you who are twins. Many of my best friends are twins, and we don't fortunately, hopefully, feel this way anymore. But there was the deep discomfort with twins in the past, right? Because twins could be, for example, in traditional thought sometimes, the offspring of two fathers, right? Either because of adultery or sometimes because there was a divine father of one twin and a human father of another twin, which here we see maybe one of the reasons for some Christian traditions which actually hold that Jesus and Thomas were twins. This is partially because another name that Thomas had was Judas, And Judas was also the name of one of Jesus' brothers. But that's not a story that most biblical interpreters and scholars put much stock in today, but it is there in the tradition. And we can see why that opens up many symbolic possibilities, right? If Thomas is Jesus' twin, you can see how that's rich with possible interpretations. And in fact, I think Jesus, not only Jesus and Thomas, but also Thomas and Mary Magdalene are clearly twins. They're the only two characters in John's post-resurrection account who we really get to see inside their minds and their hearts to see how do people react to these deep mysteries of life and death. To me, they are clearly the protagonists of the human part of this story at the end. So I think Thomas and Mary are twins. But at any rate, in most times and places, twins have become associated with dangerous, difficult pregnancies for both mothers and children. It's dangerous to have twins. And perhaps the name Thomas or twin was the name given to a second child after the intended name, the important name, the family name had already been given to the first child, right? And I should mention here, Thomas, that that's not what we did in your case. Your name was our first choice. You were named after a dear friend. But this may explain, Thomas may be one of these underdogs, right? One of these figures who's had a tough road in life, being the, you know, the runt of the litter, the unwanted second child. And again, like Mary Magdalene, perhaps his underdog status is part of the reason John puts a spotlight on him here at the end of his gospel. In fact, the use of the name twin by John here echoes the first time that we hear this applied to Thomas, which is during the story of Lazarus. And if you remember, Jesus wants to go, when he hears that Lazarus has died, he wants to go back to Bethany, and he wants to do something. But the disciples don't quite get it. Thomas immediately stands up and says, "You do it. I know it's dangerous to go back there. You're probably going to die. We're all going to die, but let's do it. We'll go with you. We're with you to the end here," right? And he shows a tremendous amount of courage in the face of certain danger. But he also displays that he doesn't quite get where Jesus is aiming at either. He doesn't quite understand where this story is going. The point of the story is not going to be that everybody is going to die, but rather that there's a different human relationship with death that Jesus wants to literally show. So maybe Thomas doesn't quite get it, but he's not reprehensible either. He is singled out for his energy and his action, his decisive boldness. And let's ask ourselves for a minute, in the story that we're looking at today, why is he not with the other disciples after Jesus' death? The disciples are explicitly, the text says, hiding because they're afraid, right? They are under political threat because of what has happened. Thomas, perhaps, has said, "You know what? I'm not going to hide right now. This is not the time for hiding." Perhaps Thomas has said, "This is the time to go out into the world and do what Jesus said needs to be done." Maybe that's why he wasn't there. And maybe it's that same quality of, I don't know, determination, obstinance, just being an ornery kind of a difficult person with a strong personality. Maybe that's why he wasn't there. But maybe that's also an important character trait in some ways as well. Thomas's doubt, I think, is what Paul Tillich calls the doubt that is a necessary part of faith. If faith means risking everything and putting everything at stake to do what needs to be done and what should be done in the world, then perhaps doubt is a signal that we're doing something right, that we really have put something at risk. Without risk, there's no doubt. There's only a kind of dry certainty. Perhaps that is Thomas's key attribute. So the first time Jesus appears to the disciples in the upper room, Thomas misses out. Why are they there a week later? Have they not moved in a week? Do they do this every week? I don't know. The story doesn't tell us. I actually think that here we're in the realm of traditional logic, the logic of fairy tales and traditional stories, of oral stories, right, where repetition is how you signal that there's something important happening here. It's like in fairy tales where you should always pay attention to what the third sister or the third brother does because they're the ones who will actually get it right, right? So there's this repetition. Thomas is there the second time. The whole story is building up to this moment, and I don't know if it's almost too stark a word to call it a confrontation between Thomas and Jesus, right? Thomas feels this compulsion to reach out and do something, to touch this mystery, to put everything at risk and say, is this really what's happening? Do I understand what's going on in my world here? This reminds me of a couple of weeks ago, I went to, with Jessica and the boys, we went to hear Stinky Cheese Man, which was a live theatrical production of the postmodern fractured fairy tale, which I highly recommend the book if you ever get a chance to look at it. But it was only a few minutes into the show that Leo announced, you know, this is not going to happen. These people are too loud and everything is too real, you know, the characters, and it was just too much. So I took Leo and we exited the back of the theater, and I actually missed Thomas actually playing Goldilocks later on in the show, so I'm sorry I missed that. But Leo and I spent the next hour or so walking around the quads at Notre Dame, and one of the things we did was we looked for the statues that are just everywhere there. And yeah, hi Leo. And we went and we found all the great statues, and I remember there was one statue of Jesus teaching. There was a group of people gathered around him. This was a life-size statue. And Leo was fascinated by it. So he went up, and he was looking at it, and I was just about to pat myself on the back for my great parenting about encouraging him to sort of explore the world around him and appreciate art. When suddenly I see his finger reaching out, and just as I was about to say, no, we don't touch art. It's not what it's for. But too late. In an instant, his little finger had reached out and right up Jesus' nose. Right? And I thought, A, whoa, let's get out of here. But B, I thought that was kind of cool. Because, you know, that's the human impulse, right? To reach out and try to touch and understand with our senses what maybe even doesn't make sense in our minds. I think that this whole Thomas story is about that moment where you reach out and you try to touch things that are impossible to grasp, and all you have is your senses to go by. And I actually think that it's the reason why we incorporate art into worship, right? It's the reason why there are things that we can't fully put into words, but we keep visual, tactile, colorful representations of them here with us as we worship. It's the reason why we have roses and candles on our piano. It's the reason why we have music in the service. It's the reason why behind me there's an amazing piece that seems to be drawing us into the many hidden dimensions of reality, right? These are things that it's very difficult to work into words, but we have not only the ability, but almost the compulsion as human beings to try to understand these mysteries in ways that make them tactile. So a kindergarten teacher was walking around observing her children in the classroom while they were drawing pictures. And she got to one girl who was working diligently. And she asked her, what are you drawing? And the little girl said, I'm drawing God. And the teacher paused and said, well, that's very good, but you know, nobody knows what God looks like. And without looking up, the little girl said, oh, they will in a minute. And I think that is the spirit in which Thomas is reaching out. He's saying, you know what? I don't know now, but I will in a minute. And it's not an act of impiety so much as a basic human compulsion to understand the world through art and through the senses. Two last stories here are really just quotations. They're poems and a passage from a short story that I think get at this need for us as human beings to get out into the world and press the boundaries of doubt, to take those risks that always include doubt, and really see if we can experience things more fully. The first is from Mary Oliver's poem, Foolish. No, it's not. Sometimes I spend all day trying to count the leaves on a single tree. To do this, I have to climb branch by branch and write down the numbers in a little book. So I suppose from their point of view, it's reasonable that my friends say, what foolishness, she's got her head in the clouds again. But it's not. Of course, I have to give it up. But by then, I'm half crazy with the wonder of it. The abundance of the leaves, the quietness of the branches, the hopelessness of my effort. And I'm in that delicious and important place, roaring with laughter and full of earth praise. And finally, from George Saunders' story about his trip to Dubai. This is actually a nonfiction story where he's a journalist. He goes to Dubai for GQ magazine. And I won't ruin it for you. You can go read the whole thing. But at the end, he's on the plane flying home. And he thinks to himself, just before I doze off, I counsel myself grandiosely. Forget concepts. Don't be afraid to be confused. Try to remain permanently confused. Anything is possible. Stay open, so open forever that it hurts. And then open up some more until the day you die, world without end. Amen.